Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around, you're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am here with the one and only Adrian Galish. Adrian's an LA-based guitarist. He's an in-demand solo artist, session guitarist, published author, and educator. He's released 6 albums, including his latest release, Venusian Sunrise, which we'll talk about. Artists like Jennifer Batten, who we interviewed a long time ago, and outlets like Power Play Magazine have both praised and talked favorably over Adrian, and he's had a successful trajectory that includes numerous collaborations and performances with industry giants like Uli John Roth. Man, what a great guitar player that guy is. Yngwie, I listened to him religiously as a kid. Robin Ford, Mike Keneally, George Lynch, Warren DeMartini. Man, that's another guy from great player from the past, and more. Adrian's also Guitar World Magazine's online lesson columnist, and he's education coordinator for Guitar Center Lessons. He's also the author of the book called Progressive Guitar Warm-Ups and Exercises, and he has a Brian Moore signature guitar, man. That's awesome. Hey, man, thank you for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
No problem. I appreciate you having me.
Hey, so your latest album, Venusian Sunrise 20th Anniversary Edition, that album, as I understand it, that's a re-release of was this like your first record you dropped?
Yeah, that was my debut record back in 1998.
Okay, and what's different about it this time?
Well, put it this way. When I originally recorded that, I was about 21, 22, maybe 23 years old. And I recorded it in my parents' basement on a single Alesis 8-track ADAT. And, at the time, I was inspired by guys like Steve Vai with the Flexible album and the early Joe Satriani records where he had all these programmed drums. And I was like, man, I could do this, or I want to do it, you know? And that was kind of my goal, is to, man, I just graduated music school. I needed sort of like a calling card to get out there and do things. So I thought, I'm going to record all these songs that I've been writing and I'm going to do it myself. And at the time, you know, limitations notwithstanding, you know, the album turned out all right, and I released it, and the CD sold out, and kind of put me on the map as far as guitar circles goes, and let me, you know, get to record my next few albums with the people I got to record those with. But over the years, looking back, I was, you know, after you keep listening to it, it felt like demo quality to me as far as, you know, over time, being able to record better records, better sounding records, my playing improving. And just, man, over time, it was like, it got hard to listen to that first record.
Sure.
From just a personal standpoint. So I decided to re-record it. And of course, I wanted to re-record it for years, but it didn't happen until this past year. And I just figured, you know, after all this time, looking at the calendar, I was like, man, it's going to be 20 years already. I should probably just make this sort of a thing. And the biggest difference, you know, is going to be the production. It just sounds better, fuller. There's live drums, you know, everything about it, you know, brings my 20 years of experience to the table.
Okay, so you actually re-recorded these songs. This isn't like the original songs, like, touched up.
I mean, from scratch.
Oh, wow.
Every single track, every keyboard part was replayed, every guitar, bass part, everything. I had to relearn a lot of what I did for songs that I haven't played in 20 years.
Sure.
And figure out what the hell chords are these, and, you know, parts that I haven't played, like the keyboard parts was the hardest part. Guitar, I was like, yeah, I know what I did back then, because I play guitar every day, but my keyboard chops ain't what they used to be. And totally every song was recreated from scratch.
Okay, so let me ask you this, because this may not make sense, this question now. I originally thought it was the original recordings, and you just sort of like technologically modernized it. Did you play that good at 20? I mean, or I was like, holy shit, how the hell did this guy do this at 23?
The CD I put out has both the original recording remastered, the new re-recorded versions, and a couple live bonus tracks. Mm. Now, there are things on the original recording that I go, man, my intonation or my timing was a little funny there. Or, you know, maybe I was just trying too hard, trying to prove my technique and overplaying there. So the biggest difference is maturity, you know, comes to the newer recordings. And back then, little things that probably didn't bug me as much back then that bug me now were sort of the problem. Now, that isn't to say there weren't parts on the original recordings where I was scratching my head going, what the hell did I do? I can't even play like that anymore. But that was me being a kid coming out of college where I was practicing, you know, technique 8 hours a night or something.
Okay. But that was, it was really, you know, the new one that I listened to, it was incredibly clean. So I don't know what was, you know, that you said you can't play like that. It was a really clean record, man. It was tight.
Well, the new stuff I can play like.
Yeah. Shit. Have you always been a fusion player? And what about this particular genre, you know, turned you on the most?
You know, when I started playing, I began playing after hearing guys like Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen, and like you mentioned, Uli John Roth. And then right around 7th and 8th grade, I had this really cool music teacher, this band director, who said, man, you should check out this album by Joe Satriani called Surfing with the Alien. And so I got that. And of course, if you've never heard music like that before, that'll just wreck your mind. Right. You know, as a budding guitarist, to hear Satch Boogie and Surfing with the Alien, you're just like, what? And then after a while of that, he's like, well, if you dig that, there's this guy named Steve Vai, and there's an album called Flexible. Mind you, this is like 1987, 88, sure, when this was just going to happen. And that blew my mind, you know. So that was probably a big reason why I just started doing instrumental music. That and the fact that I just didn't see myself as a singer, but I liked the idea of composing melodies and doing it all, you know, myself, and hearing those kinds of artists do instrumental music validated that was, you know, something that could be done and was totally okay.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Cause you could hear, I do hear Satriani's influence in there for sure. You can definitely.
Oh yeah. That whole record would be Steve Vai, Joe Satriani, and that kind of playing.
Yeah. So you're playing, besides guitar, you're also playing keys?
Yeah, I did all the keyboards on there.
Very cool. But you had a separate drummer, and did you play bass as well?
I played bass on most of the tracks, except two of them. I had Stu Hamm on bass as a guest on a couple tunes.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I interviewed Stu a little while ago. Yeah, you see, got some top guys there, man.
Yeah.
Where did you record it this time? I'm assuming it wasn't in your mom's basement, right?
No. Now, you know, funny enough, 20 years later, if you asked 22-year-old Adrian, you know, hey, if you were ever to re-record this, where would you do it? I'd be like, well, you know, the record plant or something. But with technology now, I'm still at a home studio. I got a home studio, and it's all done on a laptop as far as guitars and keyboards and bass and that sort of stuff. Stu recorded his bass parts, I'm sure, at his house. Mm-hmm. And I recorded drums at a local recording studio here with Ryan Green producing the drum tracks. And outside of drums, you know, yeah, you can still do it all at home, but man, is it a big difference in technology from an ADAT with only 8 tracks to now unlimited tracks and unlimited sounds and plugins and amp models and everything.
Very cool, man. Hey, let's talk about a couple of the songs on the record that I really like. You had one song, Drifting Memories. I thought it was a really pretty song.
And yeah,
to me, it was like almost like a day at the beach or something, you know, sort of reminded me about that. And what I liked is it alternated between some really tasteful shredding and some really nice melodies. I was curious which guitar you were playing on that. What did you use for the overdrive? And like, was there any backstory to that particular track?
If I remember correctly, I think I initially tried to record it with the Brian Moore signature guitar. That's the one with the Spalted maple top. Mm-hmm. And I think I did a few passes, and then I decided to redo it And I have another green Brian Moore, the exact same one that was on the original record. And I used that. And for the guitar tones, and it almost aches me to admit it, it's all done in Logic. So the plugins that are in there, I forget the amp I use, but 9 times out of 10, it's something like British Stack, you know, Distortion 1, Distortion 2.
Yeah.
But the real goal, gosh, it's, you know, there's this elusive tone, and Eric Johnson sometimes has it. And I think even he is trying to chase this tone. And that's kind of what I was going for, was this big, you know, people call it the big violin, you know, tone, where it has this good woody mid-range with good sustain. But it's really hard to dial in because it's somewhere between humbucking and single coil tone. It's not a shredded, you know, George Lynch, you know, cutting, you know, scooped out tone. There's a lot of mid-range, but it's really hard to dial in. And that's kind of what I was going for. The neat thing I like about that song to me is, yeah, the melodic parts kind of have this contrapuntal thing where the melody keeps getting starting lower and going higher and going lower and going higher. And the whole groove sort of has this relaxed thing that kind of just folds over itself. And that's probably why it's called Drifting Memories.
Really pretty song. I really dug it.
Thanks.
Another song I really thought was great memory was So Close, So Far. And like, it's not a blues, but it feels like a blues. Why is that? Like, is there like technically, like, what's going on there? It wasn't like,
funny enough, the original recording had me playing that. If I remember correctly, I was using an Ibanez Gem of all things. And when it came time to re-recording this, the original recording had like stupid dive bombs and a lot of just what sounded like, you know, 80s guitar playing to it.
Right.
And I thought, man, this is not going to cut it this time. This is going to sound silly. It's going to sound dated. And I tried a couple passes and I was like, this sucks. And I was trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do to make this not sound dated, to make it sound cool, to make it sound mature. And I had this epiphany, which I think most guitarists should ask themselves. I asked myself, I go, what would Jeff Beck do? And I literally said, if I were Jeff Beck,
what would Jeff Beck
do? How would I, and it's funny because it's like, what would Jesus, it would be, what would Jeff do?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it occurred to me, I go, well, he doesn't use a pick. So I dialed down the distortion and I got rid of the pick for most of the melody. And I just used my fingers. And that got a way more expressive sound.
Hmm.
Of course, it starts to evoke that sort of Roy Buchanan, Jeff Beck kind of tone and attack when you're just using your fingers.
Hmm.
And you get to kind of really just think about vibrato, how you're approaching the phrasing. And I think even though the melody has some twists and turns, and it's very melodic and not the blues scale at all, that approach kind of gives it sort of a, I hate to just say it, it just gives you that Jeff Beck thing, which is kind of what we just described.
Mm.
It's a bluesy sound in the vibrato and some of the licks here and there, but the melody is, you know, just this nice soaring little melancholy tune.
Yeah, right. It was very melancholy. I dug that. And you did a good job building the climaxes there.
Yeah, for that I needed a pick.
is that song about anything in particular?
You know, when you're 22, everything's about a girl. I'm sure it was about a girl that I liked. And I think I just kind of, it's bizarre. Back then, I used to think of, and this is probably what young people still do, I used to think of things like, hey, what color does this key make you think of? Or, because B is clearly green.
Of course.
Or I would be like, you know, if I had to kind of paint a mental musical picture or portrait of somebody, what would it sound like? I go, all right, well, her eyes are kind of, you know, like this, and those are blue. Those are kind of, you know, she has maybe kind of even an orient kind of, you know, look to her face. And it's just these bizarre things that I would come up with to try to paint a picture. I'm not sure how the melody came about, but yeah, it was about a girl.
Yeah. It's funny how you do that when you're younger.
I haven't written a song about a girl in probably 20, it's probably since then.
What, when you're naming, you know, naming instrumental songs is kind of a crapshoot, you know, how do you pick a name? And I was curious, are there any funny stories?
Yeah, I used to be really good at it.
It's, you know, it's like, how the hell you do it? Are there any funny stories about, like, usually sometimes guys have like, you know, oh, I, you know, ran into a store and someone said this and it was really bizarre. And so I called that song that. Do you have any funny stories about the names of the tracks?
Some of them were easier than others. You know, Venusian Sunrise to me was like this otherworldly birth or morning, meaning, you know, the start of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's kind of the intro overture to the album.
Right.
The last song, stupidly enough, I knew it was going to be the last song and it was kind of sinister. So I called it In the End. You know, so some things are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Now there's a couple acoustic songs where I thought, man, I'm really good at naming songs. One of them is called Lullaby on South Aiken Street.
What's Aiken Street? Is that like
South Aiken Street in Pittsburgh? So I was in school in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And dating this girl, and she ended up, you know, falling asleep at the after dinner. And I had an acoustic guitar, and I came up with that melody right there, and it was literally a lullaby on South Aiken Street.
That's so funny.
The other one was Miss Fabina the Ballerina, which is, again, about another girl.
Man, you wrote a shit. You shot your load on this one album, though, huh?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was a lot of epic dating back in college, I guess.
Epic dating.
And she was literally, her name was Melissa Fabina, and her friends called her Missy, and she was a ballerina, and so it had this sort of, you know, ballerina like music box kind of tone to it. So I was like, God, Miss Fabina the Ballerina, what a perfect name for a song.
There you go. Well, those are interesting song titles for sure.
It gets harder and harder when you've been married for 10 years. Just name instrumental.
Yeah, to keep name. Yeah, you better get into pets or something. You know,
yeah.
Funny stories with pets. Hey, you've worked with some pretty cool people, and I was wondering if you could talk about maybe how you got the gig, and a funny or cool or interesting story about working with each one of these people. And let's start with Uli John Roth.
I mean, sure.
What an amazing dude.
So met him in 2006. Now you got a. Remember that if you're an Uli John Roth fan, that he hadn't been in the United States on a tour since 1985.
Wow. Was that and with so the Scorpions?
No, that was him doing Beyond the Astral Skies tour.
Right.
And then he kind of just went away and started doing his thing out in Europe or whatever. But man, you know, I was such a big fan. But with that amount of time, you can't even imagine what a guy like that is, especially before the internet was the internet. Anyways, In 2004, he does a tour, solo tour, opening up for Michael Schenker. Funny enough, me and Warren DeMartini went to go see that because we're both huge Uli John Roth fans. And then about a year or two later, he decides to do in L.A. an event called Uli John Roth and Friends, 3 nights at UCLA, and he was going to have a bunch of different guests, and they were going to do a bunch of cover tunes, Scorpions tunes, original tunes, stuff like that. And about every other week, they kind of would release an announcement of all these different special guests. And after a while, I'm like, crap, I know half of these guys. I can't imagine they are all Uli John Roth fans like I am. I know I'm not Warren DeMartini or anything, but I'm going to email Uli John Roth via his website and ask him if he's got room for one more guitarist that I would be, you know, honored to share the stage. And I sent him some links to some tunes and my website, stuff like that. And lo and behold, like 2 days later, he responds saying, "Hey, I checked out your stuff. You sound great. Would love to have you."
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
That was my response.
Yeah. Holy shit. That's so cool.
It would be that easy.
Well, that's the thing. You don't know about what's going to happen with anything you do in life, you know? But if you don't do it, it certainly will never happen.
I have always had this go out there and get them attitude since I was younger. And you don't know what somebody's going to say until you ask them.
Yeah.
What I know. And so I asked about that. He said, sure. I remember a couple days before he arrived to town, he called me on my phone. And that's another one. I was like, oh, my God. 20 years, haven't heard peep out of this guy. And here he is on my phone.
That's so
and anyways, funny. He's, you know, like, hey, what songs do you want to do? He's giving me my pick. I'm like, well, let's do In Trance. Let's do, you know.
That's a great song, man.
You know, I forget. I probably rambled off a few of them. So anyways, the show comes around. We end up doing a couple songs. And he would, you know, after a couple tunes, he kept me on for a couple more. Even songs I didn't really know. So I had to, you know, go to the other rhythm guitarist and just kind of stare at his hands for the first verse and chorus. But it went really well. We did that for 3 nights. We did it again the next year, and I think we did it again the next year. And then eventually in 2011, he wanted to do a West Coast tour following the NAMM show. And I said, man, you know, if you want, I can help put together a band. And I, you know, I was the one who introduced Mark Bowles to Uli John Roth back in 2007. And he ended up recording an album with Uli. And then I said, well, we should get Glenn Sobel. And you've already got Bjorn Englund. And that became the band for that year.
That's wild.
Talk about a band. Glenn
yeah.
Sobel, Bjorn Englund, Mark Bowles, myself, and Uli John Roth.
Wow.
And it was just killer. And he knew that I just was this huge Scorpions freak. And I could learn all the tunes and that sort of thing.
That's so cool.
So that's
cool,
how
man.
That happens. And yeah, as somebody who grew up listening to that, and I mean like when I was 9 or 10 years old, staring at the vinyl record covers of In Trance and Virgin Killer and stuff like that while listening, it was mind blowing. I remember the first time we shared the stage, that there was a moment where I just got in my own head and I was like, I can't believe I'm on stage playing my favorite Scorpions tunes with this guy 5 feet from me.
That's so cool, man.
And I had to stop thinking about it. Otherwise, I'm sure I would have screwed something up.
It's funny because I'm a little bit older than you, and I was staring at Lonesome Crow and Fly to the Rainbow. The first two albums. Yeah, great, great, great stuff, man. Real good. When he calls you on the phone and he's like, Adrian, hi, it's Yuli, or I don't know how he pronounces his name. Were you like, that's got to be weird, right?
I was driving at the time and I felt like I needed to pull over, but
yeah.
I was on Mulholland Drive and there's nowhere to pull over.
Oh man.
It was exciting, and as soon as the phone call ended, I was like, holy fuck.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Yngwie, talk about that situation.
Yeah. So Yngwie, I haven't played with him. I've done shows with him where I've been the opening act a bunch of times.
Gotcha.
We share a lot of the same band members here and there sometimes. And man, we played like the Key Club, the Nokia Theater, the Key Club again, other places. And, you know, the thing with Yngwie is what you see is what you get. And I mean, when it's 12 noon and the bus pulls up behind the club, he will walk out at 12 noon with leather pants on, cowboy boots, gold necklaces, a pirate shirt, as if somebody was going to do a photo shoot. But that is what he wears 24/7.
Like lounging around the house, you think he's like in his
I think so.
His gear.
I don't think there is evidence of him wearing a pair of jeans ever.
Wow.
Oh, and I wow. mean, during sound check, he is dressed to go. Like, it's kind of weird. I know a couple people that are like that. Eric Sardinas never turns it off. For a while, Uli John Roth was a lot like that. It was like black crushed velvet, like pants and all. And it's like 10 a.m. I'm like, what the hell's going on here? Did I miss a memo? But that's the way they are. Although, to Uli's credit, recently I've seen him wear actual denim.
Wow.
Like, yeah, he's been dressing it down every now and then.
Like, what would happen if you saw these guys in like gym shorts or something?
You know what? Last time I saw Eric Sardinas, we were talking in the parking lot after his show, and I go, please tell me you don't drive a Prius, because that'll just ruin everything. He goes, no, man, it's like a 68 Caddy. I'm like, all right, thank God.
68 Caddy, holy shit, that's quite funny.
He drives exactly what you picture somebody like him driving.
Wow. How about Robin Ford? I actually interviewed him. Anybody listen to episode 291? And actually, I have Bjorn coming on the show. I'm looking forward to that. But how did it go with Robin Ford?
So Robin Ford, I met in college. He did a clinic in college, and then he invited a bunch of students to the show, and that was in Pittsburgh. And then, man, Robin Ford, we played together at a NAMM show event like in 2001. Hmm. And it was, what the heck was it called? It was like three nights at the Hilton or something like that. And of course, he had Vinny Caliuta on drums.
Wow.
And Jimmy Haslip on bass.
Okay.
And so I believe we just jammed a couple tunes, but I played again right before him. He and his band played right before Living Color, of all things.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And it was a hell of a night. You know, half the time when I get to, you know, play with other people, you know, there's some reason. There's an event where it's either a NAMM show or a guitar masterclass or camp or something like that. And I think that was one of those times. As far as, you know, me and him ever collaborating, you know, it was never like that. But, you know, I've been able to play with a lot of cool people in these situations where you're, you know, kind of just all at the same event for some reason.
Yeah, that's really cool. Hey, are you working on anything now you're excited about?
You know, the new record just came out literally a little over a month ago. So my studio needs sort of a little update. I don't know if you have a home studio, but Macintosh likes to do this thing where they update your operating system,
yeah,
which eventually makes whatever you're recording on obsolete. So now I need to update my DAW, which means I need to update my audio interface, which then means I have to update my MIDI controller. So before I start anything, that has to happen.
Gotcha.
But what I usually do after just about every record is up next, I'm going to be releasing the backing tracks for Venusian Sunrise.
Okay.
So inevitably, I have my mix engineer make me, you know, backing tracks without lead guitars, so that when I end up doing clinics or in stores or guitar camps or whatever, that I've got some, you know, tracks to play to. And then it dawned on me a few years ago that, man, I have like albums and albums worth of these tracks that I'm sure students out there would love to either, you know, learn the song and play to them, or just make up their own stuff and work out ideas over. So that'll be coming out probably in about a month or two.
Very cool.
I've always been kind of piecing together a new book, and it's going to be based on a lot of the lessons that I've been doing for Guitar World. And those lessons are usually workout based, meaning I've got like a pentatonic scale workout, a three note per string major scale workout, an arpeggio workout. And they're very musical, kind of sequential type of things that, you know, get these scales under your fingers, but gets you to actually, you know, develop a vocabulary and musical ideas with them. In the context of, you know, different keys and stuff like that. So I'm probably going to piece together that pretty soon as well.
That's very cool. So you got a few things to look forward to.
Yeah.
Although updating your operating system is certainly not one of them.
Yeah.
Where are you originally from? You said Pittsburgh?
I went to school in Pittsburgh, but I grew up living right outside of Washington, D.C. in Fairfax, Virginia.
Oh, cool. What was your childhood like growing up?
It was the suburbs, you know, so we lived in, you know, a house with half an acre. It would take you, you know, a 40-minute bicycle ride just to leave the neighborhood. It was a very big neighborhood.
Sure.
So getting anywhere usually meant you had to drive somewhere, unlike Los Angeles. you know, grade school, high school. In high school, I was in the high school jazz band playing guitar. I took guitar lessons since I was 12 years old. So a lot of what I did was, you know, music related, and I kind of met and hung out with all the other music geeks at the time. And other than that, you know, I moved to L.A. in 99, so I was probably about 25 at the time.
What made you move there?
A few years after college, you know, I did play around town, but there wasn't much to do. It's not a live scene, music scene there at all.
What prompted you to move to L.A.?
Oh, I just wanted to do music for real, and I knew it wasn't going to happen in Fairfax, Virginia.
Why not like either Nashville or New York or you know, Austin?
I did visit those ideas. I had gone to Nashville a few times. My impression at the time was, man, this is very country.
Yeah.
And where's the beach?
Gotcha.
New York was just going to be way too expensive.
Yeah.
And I also considered Miami. I did end up interviewing for a job at Gloria Estefan's studio down there after sure. I graduated college, but it just didn't seem like a music mecca outside of the Estefans.
Yeah, it's not.
And I did visit LA a couple times just to kind of come out, see it, go to the NAMM show, kind of see what things were about. And what I saw, you know, was probably a false impression. You know, you visit LA during NAMM. Well, you get this idea that, you know, the streets are just teeming with rock stars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to a certain extent, they kind of are, but not like that. But I was like, man, I got to come here. This is where everybody that I like to play and listen to is living. And I already knew some people that lived out here, too. So I knew that once I got here, I could, you know, have some friends and tag along to stuff. One of the coolest things, people, I'm sure you've interviewed him before, Carl Verheyen.
Yeah, I've got him. I'm interviewing him in a couple of weeks, actually. Funny.
Oh, very cool. I knew him before I moved out here. And one of the nicest guys you will find out is Carl.
Yeah.
And when I moved out here, I told him I moved out here. And I would be like, hey, can I tag along with you on some of your studio gigs just to see what it's like? And he's like, sure. And he gave me two addresses of two studios in one day. One of them was him doing a session for Toyota, We Make It Easy on You commercials.
Very cool.
And another one was at like Neil Diamond's studio, cutting some tracks for Neil Diamond or something like that. And, you know, he was that cool. And everywhere we went, he introduced me to the composers, the engineers, everybody. I kind of sat quiet like a fly on the wall, just checking it all out. And anytime I've ever had questions or anything, he's always been helpful. But there was a few people like that out here that could, you know, get me on my feet.
That's really cool. How did you know Carl, from back home or something?
We had done some guitar workshops together. We were both guest clinicians at a guitar camp.
That's very cool.
We ended up jamming together one of those.
That's great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to having him on the show, actually. So what you've been at this a while. What are some of the bigger obstacles that you've had to overcome throughout this journey, either music related, business, personal?
There's a bunch, you know. I would say that coming from the suburbs, from parents who, you know, had real jobs and that sort of thing, I've been used to a certain amount of, you know, income security.
Sure.
I've always had to work. I've always had a job. And when I moved out here, I, you know, temped, and then I ended up working at SWR Bass Amp Company and then a couple other like music companies. And I figured that was my way to get, you know, 40 hours a week of income to pay my rent and still be around music. And then in the evenings and weekends, I would try to do my own music and pursue that.
Sure.
The obstacle is, man, I probably really shouldn't have ever taken these office jobs, music related or not. I probably should have been, you know, eating hot dogs off of paper plates in my 20s and really putting, you know, my nose to the grindstone, meaning playing as much as possible, doing as many gigs, meeting more people, right, spending my days practicing my ass off and doing that sort of thing. So I think it was me hoping to, you know, me just wanting the security. But when I see some other artists who have really gone on to do some wonderful things and get those dream gigs we all, you know, think about, those are the ones that were, you know, probably roughing it for a good few years. But they ended up getting a gig that built upon getting a better gig and a better gig, and it kind of grew like that. So luckily for the last 8 or 9 years, I've been doing music full time again.
That's great. So you think if you had been solely focusing on music, like, you would have been in traffic more things would have come up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Imagine you're working your 8-9 hour day. You get home, you're tired because you got up at 6:45, 7 a.m. You stuck in traffic, you know, 45 minutes to an hour each way.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do on a Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday is practice for a couple hours or go back out and rehearse or go to a gig or, you know, network. It may work the first couple of weeks, but after a while you're like, damn, I'm tired. I just want to watch TV.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
I totally get it. That's a tough spot to be in, man, because you yeah, I totally get it.
And now when I go and do, you know, lectures and stuff at colleges or MI or whatever, you know, there's so much you could be doing to be working. There's so many hats you can be wearing as a musician to kind of get all that money together. And it's a matter of not being afraid to just do it, you know.
So
for somebody who said, you know, why did you write a book? I go, because, well, I teach guitar and everybody's got the same issues and nobody else has a book that tackles these issues like I do. So I wrote a book.
Well, and that's a lead gen front end to get you gigs.
Like, yeah.
You know, people read that, then they become your students, or people read that and they say, hey, this is a good book. I know. Let's see if we could work with this guy, you know? So everything leads to something else. What would you say to people? Cause obviously there's tons of guitarists listening to this. What would you say to people that are on the edge of the fence? Like, you know, how do they make the leap of faith to go out there and do what they need to do?
That's the thing. You can't be afraid. I wasn't afraid to email Uli John Roth. I wasn't afraid. Even back in college, I was already starting to write guitar method books. And nobody, you know, ever told me, no, I couldn't. So the thought never crossed my mind that I shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in college as a freshman in Pittsburgh, I saw these signs and they were for these guitar lessons with Red Beach from Winger.
Oh, wow.
And this is when Winger just ended. This is like 1993. And he was at home, you know, with nothing to do. But he convinced the school that I was at to let him teach some guitar lessons. And then he was going to give a clinic at the school. And I'm like, well, heck, I'm going to take a lesson with Red Beach. Paid him the money, took an hour-long lesson. But while I was there, I let him listen to a song I had recorded because I wanted his feedback. And, you know, stupid old me thought he would love it. And he, you know, this is a good story. You're going to like this. you know, he said, Adrian, this song is, you know, this isn't that good. And of course, my smile turned to, you know, a frown. And he goes, well, I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, the phrasing's kind of boring. And the groove is kind of the same thing over and over again. And the melody sounds like da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da. And what it should sound like is maybe more syncopation and, you know, more excitement. And it's as if he was speaking alien to me. And I went home being all disappointed. And then maybe a day or two later, you know, picked myself up by my bootstraps and I called him and I go, you know what? I know what you're saying. I listened to some of your tracks And then I compared what I heard you playing to what I'm playing. And yeah, what you play is way more exciting to listen to than what I'm now hearing. You know, I didn't have a very objective way of listening to my own songs at the time.
Yeah.
And there is no other 19-year-old around that I know that did what I did next. I said, Reb, I'm going to do a demo, but I'd like you to produce it. Would you produce my demo, and how much would it cost? And he threw out a number. I talked to my parents. I knew I had some cash in the bank, and I told them what I wanted to do. They're like, well, it's your money. You know, if you feel like this guy, you know, is going to be a feather in your cap, go for it. And I agreed to do it, and I ended up working over at his apartment, or not his apartment, his townhouse in Pittsburgh, on and off, you know, for weeks. And I watched him help me make a 3-song demo, and I learned a ton from it. I learned how he was, you know, his thought process for arranging songs, how to come up with parts that kind of glue different parts together. His drum programming is really great, and he played bass on these demos. And he coached me through tracking the guitars and the solos, and told me what's a cool take, and hey man, this doesn't sound exciting enough, get into it, and did the whole thing. And it was a big lesson for me. But if you didn't ask to begin with, I wouldn't have learned any of that. I wouldn't have gone down that road, and I wouldn't have had that feather in my cap at the age of 19 working with, you know, a guy who was getting gold and platinum records.
Yeah. Wow, that's
so
really cool.
If you're really into it, you can't be this shy wallflower. You know, granted, when it comes to networking, you need to be able to offer people something, whether it's money or a reference or a referral to other work, gigs, exchange for maybe the favor being returned later on. But you got to put yourself out there. Don't take no for an answer. Just because somebody says, man, you can't do that. Why would you do that? Are you crazy?
Right.
Well, the answer is, yes, I can, and I will, and this is how this business works.
Yeah, it's funny. I read something today. Somebody messaged me on Instagram, and I looked at their ID, and they had something there I thought was really cool. It's kind of moral of the story. It said, if something means enough to you, you'll figure out how to do it. And if it doesn't, you'll just figure out an excuse why you shouldn't do it.
Exactly. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. It was very cool. So, man, that's a good story. Thanks. So are you still in touch with Reb?
It gets harder and harder the older you get, though, to be like that.
Depends how hungry you are.
I guess so, you know.
Depends how hungry you are, yeah. And how...
Well, our goals change as we get older. Life changes as we get older, and we adjust, and, you know, it's not like I am not still looking for that awesome arena gig, but I know that I'm pretty darn happy with a guitar in my hands no matter what.
Sure. You know, I had an interview recently, and the player said he had a really valuable – well, he didn't know. He told me a story when he was younger. He met a guy – who was a jazz teacher at Berkeley, and he was also given private lessons. And he explained to him as a young player, you know, you don't have to be Jimmy Page. You're not likely to be Jimmy Page, but there's like so many different things you could do to make money. And so he had that in his mind at a young age. He was like, you know, he knew he wasn't going to be Jimmy Page. And I said, you know, I've interviewed over 300 players, and I said, you don't realize what a gift that was to you, because most players they're not clued into that early on. And when they find out that they're not going to be Jimmy Page, it's a big letdown. It's disappointing. Whereas you knew early on, hey, I don't have to be Jimmy Page, which probably took a lot of stress off you and you gave you a healthier, you know, and probably more positive outlook about being a musician in general.
Everything when I was younger was attractive about the music business, meaning I thought going into a studio and being a session guy was crazy exciting. I thought performing was awesome. I thought the idea of going out on tour with, you know, an awesome artist was awesome. I thought going to the local Irish pub and seeing two guys sing drinking songs was awesome. I thought teaching guitar was awesome. Everything about it was pretty much a cool idea to me. So there wasn't too much negative about it. Now, when I was younger, one of the tough things is not knowing who you're going to be or what you are going to sound like, not having an identity on the instrument.
Yeah.
You know, in college, yeah, I could tell that I was copying a lot of stuff I was doing from the people I was listening to. And even on that first record, it was evident that, hey, this guy was listening to Steve Vai and Joe Satriani. I bet.
Yeah.
And you just have to have confidence that you will end up not being able to sound like anybody but yourself in due time. And to me, that was sort of my biggest thing back then. I was like, God, I don't want to sound like who I'm sounding like. I want to sound like myself. How do I do that? Well, shit, Adrian, you were still learning.
Yeah.
You know, of course you don't sound like yourself yet.
I give you credit, though, for putting out that first album. Even though it does sound like Satriani and Vai, I would imagine the lessons you learned, not only the confidence, not to mention the confidence you gained from doing that, were tremendous.
It was really, I mean, the whole project was a work of, man, can I make an album? And can I do it in my parents' basement with the gear that I have?
Right.
Can I hire a company to design the CDs? And can I actually get the CDs in all the local stores? You could buy that first CD back in 1998 at the two different Tower Records, the Sam Goody at the mall, and about five other record stores around town. I was everywhere. And right. They were selling. And I would have to go and replenish. It was kind of weird.
That's great.
You can't do that anymore. But there was never somebody who said, you know, you can't do that. You need a distributor.
Right.
I go, I can consign CDs everywhere. All I got to do is talk to the manager and sign a sheet of paper.
Absolutely. That's cool, man. I think that's really good. We didn't talk about your session work, but can you talk about one or two cool sessions that you did?
You know, it's funny. I can. And I got this question recently from another interview. And the sessions I do aren't nearly as cool as people think. A lot of it is jingles and TV shows where the composer needs some guitar. And it's literally done in about an hour.
Gotcha.
And if something about Nabisco crackers or a Home Depot commercial is exciting, it isn't. It's just the neat thing is they're short 30 or 60 second little things. I'll say sometimes, you know, the challenges with these is maybe a composer gives you a chord chart or specific things to play and they don't play guitar and what they've written just ain't really a guitar part.
Gotcha.
Got to explain to them that and they don't take no for an answer. You're like, Christ, I got to be able to play them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those are the tough things. There's, you know, Carl gets to do lots of really great commercials and he does lots of albums and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I haven't been called to do somebody else's record in a long time, mostly because, man, there's just a million guitarists out there with laptops. You know, it just isn't what it used to be.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And anywhere, even in Nashville, as much as it used to be.
Yeah.
Hey, as a teacher, I just wanted to ask you like a teaching question.
Sure.
What would you advise other players to focus on in their practicing that they tend to skip over that they really shouldn't be skipping over?
Wow. The stuff that isn't fun at first is probably what needs to be done the most. And that's just proper technique. You know, my lessons involve me saying, lower your thumb, lower your thumb, lower your thumb over and over again or something. Or, you know, you got to hold more of the pick or at least hang on to the guitar so that you're not missing the strings. But the simplest of finger and picking exercises, warm-ups, things that just kind of get them coordinated and strong, people tend to gloss over because, well, it isn't making music. It's just nonsensical, you know, exercises. Everybody wants to dive into the song. And what I usually describe for people so they understand the process of learning guitar better. And all the listeners out there may want to listen to this, is 9 times out of 10, I'll ask a student, I go, man, you play a sport? And the kid will go, yeah, I play soccer. I go, cool. What's the first thing your coach has you do when you show up to soccer practice? Oh, we run around the field like 3 or 4 times. And then what? Jumping jacks, maybe some sit-ups and push-ups. And I'm like, you mean to tell me your coach wants you to get strong and fast so that you can compete and that you stretch so that you don't get injured? You're like, yeah, I guess. I go, cool, we're going to do that. And I go, what does their coach have you do after that? He goes, well, he usually breaks us up into groups. And some of us practice dribbling the ball up and down the field and then passing the ball to the other teammates and get better at that. And then sometimes we just practice, you know, kicking the ball into the goal so that we can aim and get it into the goal. I go, you mean to tell me that your coach separates the elements of the game into the various particular things that you should be practicing and getting good at so that when you actually do play a game, it goes pretty well? You're like, yeah, I guess so. I go, cool, we're going to do that.
Gotcha.
Music's got melody. It's got harmony. It's got rhythm. Scales is your key to, you know, deciphering melodies. Chords and harmony, you know, that's hand in hand. And, of course, rhythm. How the heck are we going to articulate our melodies and our chords over time? These three elements of our game is what we're going to work on separately in the beginning. And I go, what happens after that? Well, we usually work on some plays. And, of course, I'm like, hold on. You mean to tell me that you start taking bits and pieces of the elements of the game and start putting it together to make little tiny bits and pieces of games? And they're like, yeah. I go, cool, we're going to do that too. You're going to learn, you know, some riffs here and there, some different chord progressions, and get good at doing that. And you go, then what do you usually do? Well, we scrimmage and we play a game. Isn't that like learning a song or jamming and improvising? I go, can you imagine if your coach didn't have you do any of the other stuff, but on your first day of practice, had you scrimmage the team down the street that did do all that other stuff? How would that go? Well, we would get our ass kicked.
Got
you just have to have some patience. Things go in a certain order for a certain reason, and this could include learning how to ride a bicycle, drive a car, woodworking, the whole kit and caboodle. Any craft you ever wanted to learn operates with the same premise. And so it's all important. And you just kind of, yeah, we all just want to play the game. But you're going to be so much better at the game if you do these other things as well.
Yeah. It's a great answer, man. Thank you. Thank you. Hey, so what's your go-to guitar right now? And what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, there's definitely a solid three that I'm always playing. Recently, as of, man, the last maybe 2.5, 3 months, I got a Sur Modern satin finish one. They did a little custom job on that for me and put a whole bunch of gold hardware on it instead of the chrome hardware. And I really like that a lot. The neck is just ridiculous on those guitars. I don't know if you've ever played one, but man.
I haven't played a Sur, but what are they? How are they different? This is like the Strat model.
It doesn't look like a Strat. It's two humbuckers with a satin mahogany body. If you can imagine, like, similar to, like, those old Red Beach guitars where it's just a wood. I mean, I call them coffee tables, but it's just a plain wood guitar. And it's got, like, 5 different pickup, you know, combinations, splitting all the coils and stuff like that. So that's really helpful for what I do. But the neck on those is so fast. It's ridiculous. It's just one of the better playing guitars I've ever played.
Does it have the steel frets?
I believe so.
Yeah, that is such an advantage. I love that.
There's that. And you know what? The frets are huge. The neck is really cool. And when they delivered it, I originally asked to have 9s for strings on there, but they sent it with 10s. And as I was playing it, I'm like, man, I don't think these are 10s, but I've never played 10s that felt so much like just thin little 9s, and it just played so well. And then, of course, the first time I changed strings, I stuck some 9s on it because that's what I got in stock over here. And, of course, I'm like, uh-oh. You know, the Floyd Rose started leaning forward, and I'm like, that isn't what was on here. And I've been playing it with the 9s, and I'm like, the tone's missing. So I'm going to put 10s back on.
What kind of strings did he have on there? Were they Sir strings?
I think they use, they ship them with slinkies.
Okay. Yeah. I love those. That's what I use, the slinkies. I love them.
Yeah. The other two guitars that I use just about all the time, one's a D'Angelico XL1, and that's just a big old jazz box. So I get to just kind of play that if I'm on the couch, don't have to plug it in, or if I'm working on jazz and stuff like that, that's probably half of what I do. So I use that a lot. Great playing guitar. Sounds great. Looks great. The thing's a giant though. Takes a while to get used to. After a couple months when I got that guitar, I started getting shoulder pain of all things.
Oh, that sucks.
You know, your arm's so high to get over that, you know, big 17-inch body that you don't even realize that you're not holding the guitar like you normally would, and you've got the shoulder kind of cranked up. And then my other main guitar would be my signature Brian Moore guitar with a Spalted maple top. And I would say that Sir guitar that I got is very similar as far as, you know, two humbuckers, mahogany, satin finish, gold hardware, the five-way switching and stuff like that. So they're both very similar to each other. The Brian Moore I've had since 2001, and I've played it so much that I kind of just felt like I need something that I don't know. I'm not going to say I'm retiring the guitar, but it probably shouldn't be going out as much as it goes out, because it's just showing its age now. You know, it's got worn out frets and the neck and everything's kind of just sort of been beat up.
Do you happen to have the Sir? Is it handy, like in that room with you?
I've got it in the other room if you want to hold on.
I'd love to see it actually. Yeah, I love those guitars.
So you can see the body here.
Yeah, very cool looking.
And you can see how sort of iridescent this mahogany is.
Yeah, it looks great, man. So let me see if I can describe it. It's how do I describe it? It's a slab, a table. It's a
piece of wood,
it's,
man.
It's a giant piece of wood. It's as far as the body goes, it's sort of a Strat shape, but not like a Strat, really. Yeah. Gold hardware looks really nice on there with the Floyd.
Cutaway, and I guess they would call that sort of an offset body design.
Yeah. And are those Sir pickups on there?
They are. You know, I normally kind of just put Seymour Duncan's in whatever. But the guy I was talking to at Sir is like, you know what? Give these a try first. If you don't like them, we'll put in whatever you want. And I got to tell you, it's a very well-balanced sounding guitar. And one of the things that really struck me about the tones was, you know, in other guitars, if you try to split a humbucker, the single coil sound is like, it's like 80% of what you would expect a Strat to sound like. And you're like, I guess it's close enough, you know. And you can tell that it just isn't a single coil.
Being
split and trying to, you know, do that sort of half-assed. And this is the first time I've played a guitar where the single coil splits just sound like a great Stratocaster.
That's awesome, man.
You know, stands up on its own versus going, hey, not bad for a humbucker that just split.
That's great.
Which is really flabbergasting because it's like a really usable, clean Strat sound, you know, out of a slab of mahogany and a couple humbuckers.
That's really a nice thing. The gold, you know, I'm not a big fan of gold hardware, but it looks like you couldn't have silver on there. It looks really appropriate.
It originally had silver and it had those big, like, Les Paul speed knobs on it. And I'm like, you know, for the money, I want it to look like it's expensive.
Yeah.
Put some gold hardware on there. And if you compare that to my signature guitar.
Oh, yeah. It's not. It's
similar, huh?
It's pretty. It's
the gold hardware, the two humbuckers. Now, this body is way different. It's got, you know, beveled, and there's this whole sort of faux archtop thing going on. And that's a pretty cool finish there on the.
And that neck is a little. I like a darker neck, to be honest with you. That's a darker neck.
Yeah. The other one's like some sort of bizarre African rosewood of some sort. And I'm sure this is dark just from being used for the last 20 years.
Wow, that's amazing. That's great, man. Very cool. Well, enjoy it.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like you're having fun with it. Are there any players that, you know, influence your playing that people would be surprised to hear?
I think a couple would be, you know, I live sort of these dual lives. You know, one is me doing my solo records and writing music and being the solo artist. And then the other dual life is making money, which is means you're playing gigs. And that could be, you know, acoustic gigs, jazz gigs, teaching and stuff like that. The less sexier side of things. When it comes to jazz, I think, man, one of my favorites is probably just Howard Roberts, who a session guy back in the 60s and 70s and also established the Musicians Institute.
The Howard Roberts guitar.
Yeah. He had that Fusion Gibson guitar. But he came out in the 60s with these jazz records, and every song was like 2.5 minutes long. It would be like a chorus of melody, a chorus of solo, and then a chorus, and then it was done, which is like the antithesis of most jazz records, yeah, where like four songs on and that's the whole record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I was really digging into jazz and learning, to me, that was something that, like, it wasn't overwhelming. And it was something that I go, you know what? I can do that. But also his tone and his phrasing was just so concise, sounded great, and was to the point. And he didn't need to blow over, you know, 10 choruses of Satin Doll to make you enjoy Satin Doll or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I would say that's kind of a surprise. And oddly enough, for years being a Brian Moore endorser, Howard Roberts' son, Jay Roberts, was also, you know, a fellow endorser with Brian Moore. And we would end up jamming at the NAMM shows, like back in 1998, 99, and stuff like that. And I had no idea his dad was who his dad was. So, and it wasn't until years later that I'm buying the records and I'm going, holy crap, this is the same guy, you know, his dad that I was, you know, the guy that I've been jamming with. So that's probably one guy. And then on the clear opposite end, I'm always looking for different approaches when I'm writing and composing. And one that's been helpful, and it's a strange, you know, thing, is the guitarist and singer Devin Townsend.
Yeah.
Sang on the Sex and Religion album. But
yeah.
Solo records, some of it which is like very, very heavy, some of which is sort of ethereal, new agey stuff.
Is that Pete Townsend's kid?
Not at all.
No, I didn't think so. What's it? Because his son, what's his son's name? His son plays.
Pete Townsend's son is Simon Townsend.
Simon, okay.
And actually another Brian Moore user from back in the day. But Devin Townsend, you know, tunes his guitar from low to high as C, G, C, G, C, E. A big giant C chord, but tuned way down. But it sounds like this amazing harp-like, you know, tuning. But it's basically tuned in fifths. And I've experimented with acoustic songs and electric songs with that tuning. And, you know, I don't do a lot of altered tunings, but that kind of gets me out of my ruts. And I just like listening to his music.
I'm going to check him out. I've never checked out his solo stuff. Yeah, that's weird tuning.
It is. But once you do it, you're going to be coming up with new melodies left and right, because it's really easy. It's the same two notes on every couple strings, you know, and you can come up with a whole lot. It's nothing confusing like an open G or a, you know, dad gag or who knows what else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for you. for lesser mortal players like me, it was anything south of what it is now is confusing. Hey, musically, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing this could change tomorrow, what would be the first three albums, a knee-jerk reaction?
Man. Desert Island discs. What do I end up listening to all the time? I've thought about this, and the problem is you can't just pick three, so mm-hmm. I'm just gonna pick three anyways. Van Halen 1984. I'll say Ozzy tribute with Randy Rhoads, and boy, Desert Island. This has got to be something with David Gilmour on it. So, you know, somewhere between The Wall and Dark Side of the Moon. One of those two.
You know, have you heard of his first solo album?
I've heard a little bit of it.
It's great. It's not, I mean, it's nothing like Pink Floyd. It's not as good as Floyd, but it's, yeah, it's really good stuff, man. It's
his last two are pretty darn awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge Gilmore fan. So, I mean, I love anything he does, but, it's really good. It's a freestanding album I play on its own.
He's one of my favorites. He's the kind of guy who just lays out the perfect solo, perfect example of vibrato and tone and very melodic and, yeah,
I know. He's wonderful, man. Hey, so this is a tough question, or this is where the tough questions in general get a little tougher. What's the most important things that you've learned about yourself throughout this journey?
Boy, you're right. Your podcasts are like going to therapy, huh?
So I've been told.
Type of question.
Yeah, but I am ill qualified to be anyone's therapist.
And it's, I would say it's twofold. One is learning to be all right with, you know, who I am as a player, learning to like what I play and being okay that that's what it's going to be. You know, you spend your whole life trying to get good at the physical aspect of playing the instrument. And so you end up copying your favorite guitarists. And at a certain point, as you take it seriously, you wonder, man, I want to stop sounding like the people that I sound like. And when am I going to sound like me? And what is that? I mean, eventually, one day, you turn 43 or whatever it is, and you're like, wow, I guess this is the Adrian sound.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with it.
No, that's great. So,
you know, somebody once asked Prince who his favorite guitar player is. And of course his answer was me, you know, himself. And it's hard to ever admit that or say it because it comes off as being egotistical. But I always wanted to be in a place where I liked listening to my own music.
Hmm.
Do I get tired of listening to an album after recording an album and spending time mixing and writing an album and finishing an album and, you know, kind of getting off the high of, hey, this album just came out and it's in my car? Yeah, but I like the fact that I can have it on rotation for a while and not get tired of what I did. I would say also the other aspect of kind of what I learned from the career aspect is, you know, again, to just be okay with where you're at. A lot of people are always wondering, you know, or upset or, you know, jealous about the big gigs out there.
Sure.
You know, I've got a whole lot of friends that are leading some pretty exciting lives, it seems, you know, and you always wonder, well, man, when's my chance? And some people, you know, always feel like the bridesmaid and never the bride, I guess.
Sure.
But you have to learn to be okay with where you're at, meaning I still get to record albums. People still get to ask me about them and buy them and listen to them. I get to make a living with the guitar in my hands, and that ain't so bad.
Yeah.
You know, does gigging, doing, you know, jazz at a restaurant and, you know, acoustic songs at the local pub, you know, nearly as sexy as playing in front of, you know, 5,000 people? Probably not, but I have fun doing it anyways.
Sure.
I like the challenge of it, and it makes me grow as a musician. You know, at this point, to me, music is a lot like a puzzle or a game, and the fun of it is, you know, figuring things out and going, ooh, I finally got, you know, I know what the strategy is there, or having the game, reveal new angles and aspects about itself to you. You know, just when you think you figured out the guitar, somebody else comes along, or you see a video on YouTube, or you hear somebody in concert who's way better than you, or just does it differently, and you have one of those moments where you're like, you know, something else to try out.
Yeah.
That's a very satisfying aspect about being, you know, a practicing musician, somebody who's always learning and working on it. To me, that's fun. I used to feel like I got in ruts, and now I can't even imagine how or why anybody could fall into a rut with their practicing, with the sheer amount of materials out there, media out there, lesson materials out there, people just playing all around town or whatever. There was no shortage of things to be learning and trying out on the instrument. And to me, that's a pretty satisfying aspect about it.
Man, that's awesome. I appreciate you being so straightforward. Question for you. When you got to the point where you're okay with where you're at and where you're comfortable with who you are as a player, did you feel a lot less stress?
Yeah. You know, I would say my first three records was me trying to achieve something in my head and probably at the end of the day going, hey, not bad, but still, man, nah, we're at the 15-yard line here still. We're at the 10-yard line here still. And it wasn't until, I mean, I can pinpoint it, my fourth album, Tone Poet, came out, where I was like, it's finally happened, finally came together. It was a lot of work and a lot of hours, and it was a lot of tedious stuff in the studio, but I came up with what I considered sort of my magnum opus, and when I finally put it out there, response was like really great, and it was the first record to, you know, finally get me featured in Guitar Player magazine, and things were starting to really happen. And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, in life and in the career and the exposure that you want to get, sometimes as an artist you're just not ready. And when things start happening, you'll know it when you're ready. You know, you'll know when you're ready to be in a guitar magazine when the guitar magazine responds to your phone calls versus ignoring you or whatever it is. Like, who's this schmuck? Yeah. But instead they're like, oh yeah, we checked you out and yeah, you're doing a lot of great stuff and the new album sounds awesome. And of course we're going to cover you. I'm like, what? So it was then where I was like, you know what? I've got tunes, I've got playing that I'm really happy with. I've got songs and parts that challenged me as a player. And I finally got it to the 100-yard line and it looks good. It sounds good. The playing on it's good. I hired the right people to do the right jobs on it. And I felt like that album, like as an artist, I had arrived. And after that, you know, I felt like, you know, I think I can kind of do anything now. Not like superhero-ish, yeah. But I meant like, well, my next record, I'm going to do a blues record. Or I'm going to, it opens up your creative, you know, your creativity to kind of pursue other things when you feel like you finally kind of got you down. What you always wanted to achieve in the previous three instrumental records were, or whatever it is. And then you finally come up with the one is the one. Well, now that's sort of like a weight off your shoulder. You know, you finally did it. It sounds cool. I think I can now start trying out other things.
That's awesome.
Or even what I did now, which is, you know, revisit my first record. And
wow. That's a monster.
Just for fun.
That's not an easy, that's a fucking monster record.
But it was scratching an itch. Really. Yeah. Point, you know, anybody else might have said, yeah, you might want to continue coming out with new material. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing new material and I will, but there was this itch that needed to be scratched with that. So, and I felt like, you know what, I can do it now. I already proved myself.
Yeah,
you know,
I totally get that, man. Thank you for sharing. That was great. This is another tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh, God.
Oh, that's a tough one, man.
You know, it's the rugged good looks, Dave Grohl-esque physique. what do
I like? I had one. Do you know Adam Zimmern?
No.
He's out in California. I think he's in LA. He plays with Ziggy Marley, and he goes, how can I answer that question? I have so much self-loathing. He's like a typical artist. It was quite funny. And he was kidding, sort of, but, you know, it was just funny.
You know, I'll try to answer your question, but along the lines of what he said is, you know, musicians suffer from such, you know, problems. I don't know about self-loathing, but there's a lot of self-doubt.
Sure.
And I was once doing a guitar master class where was this? This is in Pittsburgh a couple of years ago. And at the very end of the class, like, kids were kind of leaving. I was maybe selling and signing some CDs. And the kid who was asking the most questions on the way out still had one more question. And he goes, "Hey, I got one more question." And I go, "Yeah, man, fire away." He goes, "You know, with all the stuff that you mentioned and all the work that goes into it and, you know, how tough the business is, do you ever feel like," I go, and he's trying to get the right words out. I go, "Are you asking me if I ever feel like I have, you know, just crippling levels of self, you know?" "Yeah." And I go, "Of course, all the time. Every goddamn musician out there has the exact same feelings, you know. Can I do it? Will I do it? Is, you know, did I make the wrong decision? Should I have been a doctor or a lawyer like mom said?" I go, "Dude, it's par for the course. If you don't have, I don't know about self-doubt, but at least the drive to know that, you know, hey, if I don't work hard at this, I could be eating off of paper plates and, you know, eating hot dogs next week. I'm not sure what else is going to drive you, you know."
Yeah, right.
You know, that. But as far as, boy, my best quality, probably my sense of humor, you know. Nothing, I don't take anything literally too seriously. And, you know, like David Lee Roth says, don't sweat the small stuff, and it's all small stuff.
Yeah, it is. How about the flip side? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would that be?
Oh, I'd probably lose weight and stop eating so much.
That's a fairly common answer.
Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Wow, boy. People surprised to hear that I cook a lot. You know, I just watch a bunch of cooking shows. I've got a bunch of cookbooks. Me and my wife love, you know, wine and going wine tasting and all that sort of stuff. So yesterday I whipped up some sort of, hey, look who's there. Some sort of,
that's actually my granddaughter.
From Pratt, and had, you know, one of my students stay over and we had dinner. And so I like to cook and, you know, host friends over and things like that.
That's really cool. People don't do that anymore, man. It doesn't seem like a lot of people do that.
Well, we're usually very busy, and, you know, I'll have to admit, as much as I like doing that, I'm as guilty as, you know, anybody else when it comes to ordering delivery 3 times a week.
Uber Eats.
Totally.
Yeah, man. Most important person in your life.
Wow. Well, probably my roommate here, my wife. So wherever she's at.
How long have you been married?
Oh, yeah.
How long have you been married?
Going on 11 years this October.
Good for you, man. Congratulations.
And as I like to joke, you know, she's like, you know, the guys forget their anniversary. And I go, "I can't forget it. It was a Saturday, clearly." I know exactly what day we got married.
Saturday. Yeah, there you go. Who's had the most influence on you musically and personally?
Let me see. There's been a bunch. As far as having the most, I would say one of the most long-lasting things, and I think I alluded to this before, was when I was 19 working with Reb Beach.
Yeah, about the...
We did it, maybe at the time, emotionally scar me a little bit to have somebody, you know, tell me that my playing wasn't very good and my music wasn't very good, but then to go ahead and turn around and help me, you know, produce a demo and learn so much in so little time working on 2 or 3 songs. And whenever I'm tracking to this day, I keep remembering literally his voice saying, you know, "Does this sound, you know, your solo sounds like da 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 da." He goes, "And that's not exciting."
That's great. No, that is so cool, though.
Solos do you hear out there that sound just like it? And what he really meant, you know, half the people, at least amateur hour, it sounds like, you know, you start your lick on beat 1 of measure 1 and you end it on beat 1 of, you know, measure 4,
yeah,
or whatever it is. And it just sounds like dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
Yeah.
And And he's like, man, you want syncopation, you want to add rhythm and make it interesting. And when you don't have rhythm and you're 18, 19 years old, that's a big mystery. So I was like, I got to find out what he's talking about, and I got to learn how to play like that and understand and get a feel for that. And, you know, and like I said, to this day when I'm tracking, it's like, is this an exciting rhythmic solo or is this dee-dee-dee-dee-da?
That thing you just mentioned, that has been an issue for a lot of guitar players, not having, at an early stage in their career, not having rhythm. And it's been a big struggle for them.
Yeah.
It's
usually really tough. And for my students, adult kids or otherwise, hell, just getting them to be able to play and tap their foot, be able to recognize this pulse and create, you know, and get an independent strumming or playing technique that's independent of a foot and them hearing a beat and that sort of thing. Luckily in this day and age, if you don't have like some kind of, you know, drum, you know, machine type of thing, YouTube's got people that just put beats down and it's odd end, and I'll have my students play to a drum beat, which certainly helps create a groove that they can recognize more readily than just the metronome clicking.
Sure.
But you know, rhythm, the neat thing about rhythm is most rhythmic figures, there's not, I mean, you could say there's an infinite amount of rhythmic figures, but when it comes to subdividing a beat, there's only so many patterns and only so many subdivisions that you're going to really use. And if you learn how to read and pronounce, you know, one E and a or whatever it is, the rhythm that you're doing, man, once they get a grasp of that and realize that, man, if they can say it, they can play it, it really makes it a whole lot easier.
I like that. If they could say it, they could play it. And how about personally, who's been the biggest influence on you?
Man, there's so many people. And it, again, it's because I've got these different things that I do. You know, when it comes to like jazz guitar, I've been pretty lucky out here in LA. We've got guys like John Paisano, you know, these guys that are in their 80s that played, you know, with all the big cats from back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Ron Anthony and Barry Zweig are these two guys that I get to jam with pretty often. I think I tagged you on a picture on Instagram.
What was that? So
that's my back patio. And every few months, I invite some people over, and we'll just kind of jam after I cook dinner. And that was Ron Anthony, who was Sinatra's last guitarist.
Okay. Who
played Sinatra for about 11 years. And then it was Bruce Kulick from Kiss at Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah, I've interviewed Bruce.
He's a closet, hollow body jazz nut kind of guy.
I did not know that.
Who loves Dean Martin and Sinatra. That kind of music.
I knew that, but I didn't know he was a hollow body guy.
And then there's Barry Zweig, who was in that photo, and he played with Sammy Davis and Buddy Rich Band back in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
So it was, you know, Sinatra's guy, Sammy Davis's guy, and
you and Bruce. That's funny, man. Yeah, I saw that. I really wasn't really sure why I was tagged on. I was like, oh, okay.
I saw to go look at it. Something about an interview with Bruce.
With Bruce. Okay. Yeah.
And so I was like, oh man, you know, if you talk to him, you know, he'll probably dig this. And me and him had done the Tacoma Guitar Festival either last year or the year before. And that's when I kind of found out about that. You know, him being way into like, he's got like old jazz boxes, old Epiphones, vintage Gibsons and things like that. And so we got to talking about that. I'm like, well, man, if you love that kind of music, I've got these two friends who literally play with Sinatra and Sammy Davis, and we jam. You should come and jam. He's like, definitely. So he showed up for that. Now, his jazz chops aren't anything like, you know, anybody else's, but he tries real hard, and he's, you know, it's obviously he's busy doing what he does.
Of course, you know,
playing American Woman and stuff like that. So. But it was really cool for him to try to do that.
That's a guess who.
or Or something like that. Grand Funk Who.
An American band.
American band.
Yeah.
But his wife, Lisa is her name, likes to sing jazz. So you'll see on his YouTube page sometimes they'll do duets and stuff like that.
Okay. I've not seen that. I know he likes that. You know, it was a big, do you know a guy named Bill Lanero?
Yeah.
Bill's a huge Frank Sinatra guy. Like, like he dresses in cufflinks that from that era or that he, there were Sinatras he bought.
Bill, he's a great player. And,
yeah, really good player.
He does the strap tight strap locks that I use.
Correct. And
one of the most amazing, wish I would have thought of it, is so easy and stupid products I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, yeah. Most important thing your dad taught you?
Wow. God, this is therapy. Honestly, I just never think of these things, but I probably should. Talk about unconditional love. I mean, here's a guy who had to put up with, you know, me. And I'm sure I was a pain in the butt sometimes. And, you know, they're so old school conservative. And my parents came from, you know, pretty poor backgrounds. But my dad worked hard and we ended up pretty well. So when they found out that, hey, I'm going to study music in college when I'm sure they were like, don't you want something like some sort of, you know, thing you could fall back on and maybe you can do music for fun and be a lawyer. You're really a good talker. Be a lawyer or something like that. And I was just like, I can't imagine doing anything else, you know? And lo and behold, I had a, you know, I paid this much of my tuition and my dad paid that bigger much. So I really appreciate that. And he's always been supportive. You know, when I do these new records, sometimes I'll do like a crowdfunding thing and he's always chipping in some money and stuff like that.
That's nice, man.
Hear what he does. And he does, still does my taxes, you know? Yeah.
I do my kids' taxes. That's quite funny. I guess that's a thing.
Well, he retired from the Department of Defense. He was a longtime military guy who retired from the Army like in 1979 or 1980.
Oh, wow.
To Washington, D.C. And then he worked for the Department of Defense for a very long time doing who knows what. And then he retired a bunch, you know, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that. And then just to kind of make money here and there, he worked for H&R Block. So
that's cool, man. He's got a good work ethic. That's great. That's the most common thing people have asked me. A common question I get from players is, what do you find the common things that good guitar players have? And that is probably
a dad that did taxes?
Yes, a dad that did taxes and retired from the military. Supportive parents. I would say, like, honestly, probably 95%, you know. And even the ones where mom was an alcoholic and dad left, the fact that they were both supportive for the most part, that's a very common trait. And I guess
there's no way to do it without it.
You
can't pursue music without your folks support.
I don't know I guess so, but that's a very, very, very common thing. And you know, it's nice to see that. Nice to hear that.
He helped me. We drove from Virginia to L.A. back in 1999.
Wow.
Drove the moving van. I drove my car. We did a cross-country trip over the course of like 7 days together. That was awesome.
That's so great. Yeah, that's cool, man. Very cool. How about your mom? What's the most important thing she taught you?
Oh, man. Probably to be polite, you know. And she was... You can't swear around her. She'll get upset. Still. Okay. And you know what it's like to have moms. You're, even though you're 43, you still act like you're, you know, 12 when you're at their house. And, but you know, again, very conservative, you know, religious, and yeah, she taught me to behave.
It's funny you say that about your kids being around the house. My oldest is 28, yeah. And then I have 26 and 18. And when my older one comes over, I see the joy in his face, like going through the cabinets and just like eating stuff and just doing the same thing he did when he was a kid. And it's nice as a parent to see that, you know, that they're so relaxed and, you know, that you can give them that. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. And my parents still live in our childhood home. So when I go home and visit, I go and sleep in my bedroom.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
They redid the whole look of it.
But, it took out, you know, the baseball cards.
Pretty much where it used to be, though. You know, I kind of know my way around still.
That's wild. That's cool, man. Anything you're still interested in learning to do? Let's say outside of music.
Oh man. I gotta admit, music takes up a whole crap load of my time. I have done really casual painting, like acrylic and that kind of stuff. And so I've done, oddly enough, painting guitars, not the instrument itself, but on camera. Yeah. And have actually even sold about 3 of them.
Oh, dude, so you must be pretty good.
And what's odd is I found out that I'm pretty good at it, but I'm good at painting guitars. Everything else, if you ask me to paint an apple or a bottle of wine or some other usual thing, I'm like, I can't do.
That's so funny, though. That's great.
But I can do some painting, and I think what I like most about it is the fact that there's no pressure.
Yeah.
I screw up, it could look like crap, and I don't have to explain it to anybody. You know, not like writing and recording an album where I've got, you know, some high expectations out of myself. It's a creative way to relax and just kind of, you know, make something and just go, there it is. Let me do another one.
Yeah, that is, hobbies like that are important, man. That's what, see, for you guys, your guitar is your vocation. For me, I play guitar. That's how I feel about guitar. It's so relaxing. It's no stress for me at all.
You know, usually I'm the same way. And even though I'll spend, you know, a day teaching guitar or recording or working on, you know, whatever projects, I never feel like, man, I can't spare it. I'm not going to spend another half hour, you know, not practice. I don't mind it. I'll just go and play some more guitar, even after the work guitar part is done.
That's great, man. 3 more questions. Toughest decision you ever had to make or hardest thing you ever had to do?
Toughest decision I ever had to make. Not sure if I remember, because people out there listening may not know that we've split this interview in half.
Right.
Did I mention taking the day job? Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And so I worked at an office out of music, you know.
Yeah, you said that was, it was tough for you because you had always.
Because I regret doing it and not spending more time. The real tough part was ripping off the Band-Aid and giving my 2 weeks notice and just leaving the security of a job, not knowing what the hell I was going to do a couple weeks later. Granted, I was teaching some guitar and I had students at a facility here in LA, but it wasn't full-time work by any stretch of the imagination. So, but I remember, man, the day after, even the drive home from my last day of work there, it was off my shoulders. It felt great. It was really hard to, you know, to just go for it and do it and make the decision to do it and leave that security behind. But I'm glad I did it.
Good for you, man. Do you remember the best advice you've been given and who gave it to you?
Carl Verheyen always has this mantra, and it's as simple as don't suck. So when it comes to going and doing a session, playing a gig, you know, I was like, so what do you do to, you know, get ready for the gigs? He goes, it's easy. Don't suck.
Don't suck.
What that really means is, you know, be prepared and do your homework and, you know, keep practicing and don't suck. I don't know if that's advice, but I'm trying to remember. You know what? Oh, yeah, I know. And this was about 2014, as a musician on occasion, of course, man, this is just going to sound more and more like therapy. But as a, you know, as a working musician, your gig has its ups and downs, and there's, you know, sometimes it rains, sometimes it pours, sometimes it's a dry spell. And I remember thinking, you know, having friends that were doing these great gigs and like, when am I going to do this? And, you know, when's my chance and how come things aren't happening faster, you know, in my career. And I sent over an email to the drummer on that Tone Poet record. It's a guy named Todd Zuckerman. He's a fantastic drummer, plays for Styx. And he used to be my neighbor here in LA. That's how I knew him. But he moved to Austin years ago. And I was like, well, maybe it's LA, man. Maybe I just need to get out of town and try something out. But I sent him an email asking about Austin, Texas, and what it's like there, what the music scene's like there. And unfortunately, his response was, I don't know, because I'm on the road with Styx 150 to 160 of the year. When I get home, the last thing I do is go see live music. Literally, I get to the airport, I drive to my house, and I try not to leave.
Yeah.
But as you know, after I kind of cried on his shoulder for a second, he goes, you know what? And I mentioned it earlier. He goes, you gotta learn to be okay with what you're doing. You gotta stop thinking about other gigs, what other people are doing, and man, I wish that was me, and that sort of thing. Doesn't mean you can't, you know, pursue those type of things, but you can't let it make you not be happy with what you're currently doing and find happiness, you know, with what it is that you're currently doing. That's probably the last bit of good advice I got, and it was very hard to wrap my head around it at the time.
It is tough if you're especially if you feel like you're stuck or you're not achieving what you should or could.
Yeah, you know, you move to LA at the age of 25. There's a trajectory you're taking, and luckily I knew a lot, you know, some people and met a lot of people and was releasing records and gigging and getting some, you know, slowly but surely some press coverage and stuff. And but you know, before you know it, you're 40 and you're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Now or never. But luckily, there's a bunch of great players that their careers don't take off until their mid-30s and 40s either, you know. There's guys like Marco Mendoza and Carl Verheyen who, you know, these guys are in their 50s and 60s and, you know, doing good.
I told you I got Carl coming on the show, right?
Yeah.
Another guy from out there, older guy, Don Peak. Do you know him?
I don't.
He was like played on like Ray Charles. He's quite a bit old. He's been on a lot of older records. Last question, dude. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this has been deliberate and how much is a part of aging?
Good God. What? No. What strings do you use?
No, there's plenty of guitar shows that talk about that, man. No, but seriously, you know what? Like, I know I don't want to ask those questions. Like, what am I going to do with that information? What is anybody going to do with that information?
I was always the same way.
I mean, like,
in college, Eric Johnson was coming to our school, and I was the one who arranged for him to arrive and get there because I was running a guitar club at our school. And, you know, at the time, I was like, guys, don't be stupid. Don't ask them what gauge strings, you know, just keep your questions. I mean, this is Eric freaking Johnson. And then some guy goes, I want to know what kind of strings he uses. His tone's awesome. I want to know exactly what. I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess so. You know, I guess it's important to some people, but it's what are you going to do with that information?
Like, am I going to sound like you if I know that you have a 1960 vintage greenbacks in your fucking amp with like, and that you put your bass on 4 and your treble on 7.5. I mean, like,
I got to admit, I'm the least gear nerd guitarist out there. It's so uninteresting to me. The less knobs something has, the better. So I can
that's how I am, man. I don't even use very many pedals. I mean, it's like,
yeah, I got friends trying to get me to get, I don't know what the hell these new modeling amps are. The Kemper.
Yeah.
Where apparently it steals your soul or something like Kemper does to American Indians. you plug it into your amp and it steals your amp soul or something. I don't know. But I'm like, dude, it looks like a medical device. It doesn't even look like an amplifier. It looks like an EKG machine.
Now, I will tell you, guys that are like constantly on the road, they have really enjoyed that because it's so easy.
Keep telling me about it. Yeah,
it's really easy.
What was the question again?
The question was, biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this has been deliberate and intentional? How much just a part of aging?
There's probably two things that I've noticed changing. I've always think I've been quick-witted, and early on, it probably reared its head as just being borderline obnoxious. At least it was witty, so I have that in my defense. So I'm probably not as over-the-top obnoxious and joking as I used to be. I try to make my jokes way smarter these days.
So you're just like more considerate of thinking about the other person that you're talking to, probably.
As opposed to just, you know,
just going off the top of your head.
Shouting crap out of my mouth just to see, get a reaction.
Yeah.
Which is probably what I used to do a lot. And then I would probably also say that, you know, in the beginning of my career and just, you know, in the pursuit of music, you know, I hate to admit it, but, you know, as you get older, your energy levels are different.
Yeah.
You know, same reason I'm not at the gym every day like I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably that as a difference, meaning, you know, I used to go out every other night, see live music and network and hang out and do the whole Hollywood hang thing all the time. I would say because, one, I wasn't working as a musician like I wanted to. And that was what I thought was going to lead to meeting people and getting gigs. And it did. But these days, you know, there isn't a day that goes by where I'm not doing some sort of guitar work for money. So
yeah.
I don't feel like I need to go out every night and do the networking hang. I'm sure if I did though, I don't know. That'd probably be better. Yeah. You know how it is.
Yeah, sure.
Totally. It's 9 o'clock on a Wednesday and you're not out of the house yet. Well, you can pretty much kiss that. You're not leaving the couch.
You don't have kids, right?
I don't.
Okay. Yeah. That's if you have that, I could imagine that would be really tough on a musician. Well, cool, man. Listen, I cannot thank you enough for your time, for being so real and keeping things straight. And, let me tell people where they could find you. It's Adrian Galish. I'll spell his name. It's Adrian, A-D-R-I-A-N, Galish, G-A-L-Y-S-H. And you can check him out on his website at adriangalish.com. His new record, which is awesome, it's called Venusian Sunrise. I love that name. There's a kind of where did I see, like, this is like maybe just being a guy. I think of like these women, hot women in like Venusian outfits with big boobs. There had to be a movie with like the Venusians or something, no?
Should have had you make the album cover.
No, I have no graphical talent at all. Venusian Sunrise, something like that. Anyway, it's a great album. If you like really good playing. Really well done album, well engineered, well mastered, and the playing on it is really cool. And you can find it on Adrian's website. You can also find it on Spotify, I think, correct?
Yeah.
And all the major places. And that's it. Are your gigs on your website?
Yeah, they can see all my gigs, the links to anything, anything and everything is all on the website.
Very cool, man. Do you want to promote any social media?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook if you just do facebook.com/AdrianGalish or twitter.com/AdrianGalish or Instagram, the usual.
I hear you. Well, man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate your time. I hope people check out your record and check out your music.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks so much to Adrian Galish for spending time with us. Please check him out online and go to his gigs and support him, especially if you're in the California area. Make sure you get California area like it's a mile long, especially if you're in the LA area.
Yeah.
Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com and sign up to get on our newsletter list. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more five-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.